Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Welcome back to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. Great to have you for another episode. I'm Ali Maxwell, with me Mark Carey, with me Liam Tharm, and the returning Michael Cox. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Ali.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Little couple of weeks off for you? Bit of rested and refreshed?
Yeah, there were some football games involved, of course.
Which ones?
I went to Rotterdam and I saw Excelsior 1, Volvic 1, and also Sparta Rotterdam 2, Ajax 2.
Oh, cool.
And then I was in Madeira where I saw Maritimo's women's side lose 4-1 to Damiense.
Wow.
In a very rainy Funchal.
Would Damiense have had to travel from the Portuguese mainland for that?
I believe they're Lisbon-based, yeah. I think they're one of those sides that don't have a men's equivalent, as their name suggests.
That must have been a fun flight home after a big away win. A thumping.
Although maybe not, because you get a lot of...
Turbulence.
Yeah, a lot of turbulence in Madeira, so maybe not, yeah.
We have caught up about our respective time spent in Madeira. Incredible microclimates, honestly. Changes every 50 minutes or so. It's worth going just to experience that alone. Great to have Michael back and the gang with us. We're going to check back in with the Premier League title race on this episode. It's about 5 weeks ago now that we analysed the three-horse race. We talked about why that was unusual and therefore exciting to have three teams so tightly packed at that stage. And clearly, that is still the case. It is still tight. In fact, as we record on a Thursday, we are unusually right in the middle of a game week, which has seen Arsenal and Manchester City pick up 3 points on Wednesday night, and Liverpool host Sheffield United tonight. They have a chance to get that two-point lead back. And we've also had some big fixtures, Michael, involving these teams. Since we broke down the three-horse race, City have played Liverpool and Arsenal, and they've drawn both games. 1-0 with Liverpool and 0-0 last weekend against Arsenal. You tweeted at half-time in that game, there's a real danger that this match will be described as tactically intriguing. Didn't get the pulse racing?
No, I mean, I think this is what kind of broadcasters say when there's not that much happening with the game and they have to be polite about it and say that something interesting is happening. But I tend to think actually the more open games are more tactically interesting in general. And I thought this was really poor. I thought both sides were really cagey, defensive. You know, the game started with 8 centre-backs on the pitch. I thought the only real flashes of excitement in the first half came after Rico Lewis was brought on, but he was only playing once City were without Stones and Ake and Carl Walker. And I don't think there were any goal-scoring chances, really. Maybe there was the Ake kind of half-header from a corner that he didn't really get contact on. Gabriel Jesus snatched at a couple of chances. Trossard probably should have done better in a counter-attacking situation, but I can't remember either goalkeeper making a difficult save. I thought it was a really disappointing game.
It was similar to the reverse fixture, really, in terms of being very cagey like that. I think people often underestimate how, I think particularly Guardiola, we've seen it in the Champions League, especially in away games, can be quite cautious and very much set up to not concede. I guess it's a different way of defending with the ball. Both teams engaging in quite a high block, but not necessarily pressing that aggressively, but trying to sort of shut off those options more. I think it was Theo Walker afterwards said that it was almost like a European type performance from Arsenal, which was like the best way to describe it. I've seen people sort of analysing it in various ways. Some are like, we used to call this, you know, parking the bus back in the day, and it's like it's not quite all the bodies behind the ball. There were times where they drop a winger down and make sort of a back five. I don't think it's fair to just call it tactically interesting, because it probably wasn't. It was probably exactly what you'd expect from those teams to set up in that way. And there's obviously the broader caveat that this comes in a season where there's been a load of goals in the Premier League and a load of big games. I think that's like the Chelsea City one, for instance, that 4-4 game mm-hmm. where there's been lots of goals. So it probably feels, relatively speaking, more boring or more bland because it comes, you know, in amongst all those games where they've had a lot more goals.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've been spoiled this season more than ever in terms of the goals. And people were saying, again, it harked back more to like the mid-2000s of Chelsea and Liverpool just always having a 0-0 and having more of the what was deemed to be the tactical battles. But yeah, I mean, I agree with the guys, specifically like what Michael was saying about it being quite risk-averse, really, I think. And, you know, I did the live piece on that day, and the numbers to sort of back up Arsenal being quite risk-averse came from the back. Obviously, their build-up is normally so, so strong, and they'll take their time with it. But David Raya was going long a lot. He had the most long balls this season, and his share of long balls across all of his passes was the second highest of the season. Mm. So it was kind of an if in doubt, get it out sort of Sunday league vibe at times, because you just had to, you know, knowing that Manchester City were so strong and have been so strong in pressing from the front, there was just little room for any risk. And that made for a 0-0.
Michael, given that City were involved in both games, I'm interested to know how you reflect on it from their point of view, picking up a point from each, neither winning nor losing these massive games. You were still leaning towards City taking the title when we spoke 5 weeks ago. Do you think those results have made that more or less likely, or around the same?
Around the same, I suppose, really. Two draws. I thought they were quite disappointing at the weekend and weren't getting the good players in the game often enough. I thought it was interesting. Guardiola almost completely reshaped midway through the second half, brought on Doku, brought on Grealish, dropped Bernardo Silva into midfield, but didn't think they were any better, really. And it was another game where I thought Haaland was pretty quiet. And, you know, as is widely acknowledged, if he's not scoring goals, he isn't really doing that much. Guardiola tends to not want a player in his mould. If he scores 40-odd goals like he did last season, then he's certainly worth accommodating. But in some games, I do think he's a bit of an issue. And as well as Saliba and Gabriel played for Arsenal, I thought they were probably the best two players on the pitch. I think they're probably quite happy, just a striker playing up against them. Physical battles, you know, they got two big centre-back side the side. Maybe someone who drops into deeper positions would have caused them more problems.
What I find interesting, Mark, is because it is so tight at this stage, because we're also engaged in it, and because there are three teams involved, and you can, if you push yourself to, make a case for all of them to win the league. So if you have a stance or a prediction, if you like, it's generally leaning towards one of the teams rather than, you know, nailing your colours to the mast. And that's where people like myself and you might look at probability models to see how they see things. And one thing that caught my attention was that there are two companies that excel when it comes to data insight and visualization. One of them, Opta, of course, and the other, 21st Group. Now, they do really interesting probability visualizations at this stage of the season when things are getting so tight. And I was just interested in understanding the discrepancy between two companies broadly trying to do the same thing, but coming out with what seemed to me like fairly different results. So after the draw between Arsenal and Manchester City, 21st Group's probability suggested Liverpool 38%, Arsenal 35%, and Man City 27% at that stage. Whereas Opta, after that round of fixtures, went with Liverpool 47.7%, significantly more. Manchester City 33.5% and Arsenal down at 18.8%. Probably a difficult question, but why could two models from two trusted data intelligence sources differ so much?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's worth noting just how much these probabilities are being rolled out in mainstream media now. Obviously, I think it just speaks to the time that we're at in terms of the analytics boom and the fact that that is kind of being used. But I think that the basic answer would probably be that I think it's just the difference in terms of the variables and the weighting that's been used in each model. And naturally, these models and these data providers are going to differ. I'm not privy to the workings and the model of 21st Group, but I know that Opta, when they talk about their supercomputer, have got it on their website, and they say that the model estimates the probability of each match outcome. And they use betting market odds and their Opta power rankings, which we've spoken about before, just looks at the team strength and the fluidity of that across the season. So I'd probably say that because of the betting odds maybe coming into it, that might be a factor.
Those markets have historically, and this season, I think, fancied Manchester City more than perhaps those two other teams.
Yeah, and I think this weekend just gone is the first time that Manchester City haven't been the favourites across the whole season, which I think is interesting. But I think one thing as well is that the odds and the rankings are based on historical and recent team performances. And I was actually speaking to Ollie Kay, one of our writers at The Athletic, about this in the week, and he was saying that if it's kind of including it based on a year's worth of time, you think back and Liverpool had a bit of a resurgence at the end of last season and Arsenal had a bit of a downfall. If they are accounting for that, even a small amount, then that's maybe kind of skewing the whole weighting there, because it, as we look at it, we've come on to the fact that Arsenal are so strong defensively, Liverpool are a bit weaker in the transition, etc. But I wonder how much they are sort of placing weightings on that. So I guess overall, the answer to it would be just differences in the inputs and the weightings of the model.
Or both companies, both firms, I was going to say. So at the start of the week, both companies leaning towards Liverpool as the favourites for the title. Let's check in with these teams. And, you know, in the context of our discussion 5 weeks ago, weighing up their strengths and any potential, mostly tiny fallibilities, see if there are any new developments or themes that might change the way we talk about the title race. And let's start with Liverpool. I feel like you guys were talking a lot about problem solving within games, strong record in the second half of games, substitute scoring goals, that being a strong narrative, but open games in comparison to City and Arsenal. Anything to update on that front?
Well, it's been a continuation of that, I think. We saw most recently against Brighton coming back again from 1-0 down. I think it's the seventh time they've won from a losing position or 1-0 down this season. And it's something like 26 points, which are records for definitely a fair while. But there's also elements of the 2019-20 title winning season with, you know, that was all the focus around the wide triangles, particularly down the right. Obviously against Brighton, you were missing two-thirds of that triangle. Jordan Henderson is obviously no longer at the club. Trent Alexander-Arnold, not fit. So Conor Bradley and Alexis McAllister fulfilling those roles, and Salah from the right playing inside an awful lot more, and Bradley having space to push on. And they were really, really good as a trio. I thought Alexis McAllister, his passing range was absolutely phenomenal. He kept sort of finding these passes in the half space to really split the defence when left-back Purvis Estupiñán would go wide to Conor Bradley. And Brighton just really struggled to defend that. And the winning goal comes from a really nice move down the right. Szoboszlai sort of joins in and makes it a sort of a 4v3 situation, and they get a neat move, pulling it inside and finding that pass. So it's, again, I'm sure, as we sort of said, and don't want to sound like a stuck record, of Klopp won't want the team to keep going 1-0 down or going behind in games. And part of the reason they conceded that opener really was because of how aggressive they were being down that right-hand side and committing bodies forward, and Brighton counter-attacked into that space. So it's something we'll come on to, I think, with City in terms of defending transitions, but it's weighing up, I think, how aggressive you want to be going forward in terms of them being more conservative, which is obviously something we're seeing more with Arsenal now. But Liverpool's right side, given the changes that it's gone through, I think looks really, really good.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that Conor Bradley is more of a traditional Klopp right back in terms of kind of being a bit more swashbuckling down the right-hand side, and it showed at the weekend. I think in terms of the next few weeks for Liverpool, I think one thing in their favour is the fact that they've got a lot of players who are coming back from injury. And we've spoken a lot about Liverpool injuries and how they had to dig quite deep into the squad to get over the line in the Carabao Cup final as well. But they've got Curtis Jones, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Alisson Becker, of course, Diogo Jota, not far off coming back from injury. Dominic Szoboszlai, as Liam mentioned, is coming back now as well. And I think tactically for Liverpool, I think one thing that's playing, you know, into their favour recently as well is that, I mentioned it before, but it's been a theme of their season that they've been quite vulnerable in the transition. They are such a good transitional side going forward, but they often have vulnerabilities, you know, the other way. And I think that Wataru Endo, and I know that Michael said that he was quite weak at times earlier in the season, which I do agree with. I think he's really kind of found his role really neatly and really well. He's so good in the counter press, really catching the opposition on the blind side to just kind of stifle them before they even have time to look up and turn. And he's just so, so combative. And I was looking into the numbers of a metric we've spoken about before, true tackles. So that's tackles and plus challenges lost, plus fouls committed. So it's an inclination for a player to stick a foot in, if you like. And doing this per 1,000 opponent touches, so to account for opportunity. And Liverpool are the only team to have two players within the top 10. So I think we talk about Endo as being such a combative midfielder, but Alexis McAllister, because of his on-ball qualities, it may be underestimated, but he gets through a lot of work out of possession as well. And I think Liverpool have finally found a good blend of stopping counterattacks and stopping transitions. Mm-hmm. So that bodes well for the final few weeks of the season.
And McAllister's stock has risen sharply, I would suggest, in the last month or so as well. When it comes to Arsenal, Michael, they've been in fabulous form since that relatively brief dip around the turn of the year, which a lot of which, as discussed at the time, came down to finishing their chances.
Yeah, that's the constant debate, isn't it? And it's the constant debate because Manchester City are the complete opposite, obviously, with one guy completely dominating the goal scoring. And we've mentioned earlier in this podcast, you know, the issues with that. I do think Arsenal are quite interesting because if you're going to look at them and say, is finishing a problem? Well, you look at the XG and they're overperforming it by the most of anyone in the league by 9.5 goals. But that's not to say they'll keep on doing that. And I do wonder whether they will have to find even more sources for goals, because I thought, for example, the way Gabriel Jesus, as I say, snatched a couple of chances at the weekend, after a really good start, first 2 months, he's proved useful in other aspects, but his finishing has been really lacking. And actually, that is a pattern throughout his career. And I think it was Ian Wright said if Arsenal had Martinelli instead of Jesus at the weekend, maybe it would have been a different story. But I thought it was interesting that Eddie Nketiah came on yesterday against Luton and looked quite lively, had one good effort. Because I just feel like there's going to be a game where Arsenal are really, you know, dominating possession, struggling to break down the opposition, lots of the ball in kind of tight situations in the penalty box. I still think they lack maybe one player who can just find half a yard of space and find a shot. And I wonder whether Nketiah could be that man. So often, it feels like in the run-in, you get these slightly random players who prove crucial. I think of Makeda for Manchester United and Ujoa for Leicester had a really big impact. But yeah, it's just something to watch out for. I mean, there's two ways of looking at the XG. Either you can say they're overperforming it by 10, so it hasn't been an issue at all. Or actually, when you look at how many chances they're creating, not quite as much as their goals for tally would suggest.
I think there's the case of feast and famine, right? It's easy to look at it at both ends of having a period where they were quite wasteful and then a period where they seemed to score, you know, just a freakish amount of goals in that succession of games. In 10 league games this calendar year, they've scored 35 and only conceded 4. So I think the XG point maybe becomes a bit less important when you realise how good their defence is, that you don't even need to create that much because you need fewer goals to win a game. It's intriguing to see how they sort of construct the forward line and the difference of approach that Arteta seems to go for. I think particularly in bigger games, possibly having Havertz as the 9, Trossard as a false 9 option, or having him off the left. Obviously, they've got to deal with the Martinelli injury and possibly phasing him back in, which is important because, and I was looking at the numbers actually, they've had way fewer changes to their starting 11, which was a theme last season and quite a stick to beat them with actually at times, was, you know, you're lacking in the depth, which they've definitely added to.
But he's still not making changes to the same extent as the
not comparatively
levels.
So if you look at City, they've had 81, Liverpool had 79 lineup changes. City haven't named an unchanged team all season. Liverpool have done it once. See, this is before Liverpool play Sheffield United, so an extra game for City and Arsenal to factor in here. But Arsenal down in 13th for lineup changes with 54. City and Liverpool are third and fourth in the, if you want to call it a table for that respectively. And obviously maybe that's down to better fitness, better training, but you see how well the established relationships are really working down the sides in particular, that they've dealt with that period of teams doubling up on them, the lower blocks, and, you know, turning Declan Rice now from just sort of a 4, adding in Jorginho more to getting Declan Rice to sort of crash the box. So they're finding solutions, and their defence is, it's still really, really good. They're 5 points off where they were at this stage last season, but I'd argue they're actually better now. This is the point last season where they went on that run of drawing games, dropping points, conceding early goals at home, not winning for, I think it was 4 games, and that counted them out. So I don't want to give them a kiss of death here, but you feel like they're in a much better position than where they were.
I think you mentioned relationships, Liam, but partnerships in general, and obviously the main one being William Saliba and Gabriel. That you think about it in comparison to Manchester City and Liverpool, who have been forced to or have chosen to rotate their centre-back partnership or three at times, whereas Arsenal have just been formidable with their centre-backs. And we spoke about it a lot in terms of their defensive numbers, but it is worth just reiterating it, that their 0.65 expected goals against per 90 is the best in the top five European leagues, which is just phenomenal. And as I was just preparing for this podcast, I saw something from Opta, and they said, since the start of 2024, Arsenal are the top-ranked team in the Premier League for goals conceded, just 4 XG faced, 4.5, clean sheets of 6, shots faced, 77, and big chances conceded, just 5. So, you know, it's the whole team that work out of possession, I get that, but the centre-back pairing have been particularly phenomenal.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about Arsenal, and I mean, they've got the best defence, I think that's pretty clear. But I mean, Liam says because their defence is good, they don't need to score as many, and to a certain extent, that's true. I mean, you can look at the goals for tally, and Arsenal scored the most, but they've actually also had the most number of games where they haven't scored. So they haven't scored in 4 games. City, it's been 3. Liverpool, it's been 1. I know it's obvious, but if you don't score, you won't win the game. And I think there's a good chance when you look at how good Arsenal's form is and the previous records of Liverpool and City in run-ins, you know, when they've gone up against each other and they've basically both gone on massive winning runs, there's a chance one of these three sides could get 100% record from now to the end of the season. And, you know, Arsenal's goals for tally is very good, but that's boosted by 6 goals against Sheffield United, 5 goals in the other game against Sheffield United, you know, big goals against Burnley, West Ham. There have been some games where they haven't scored. I haven't checked the stats, but I would think 4 games where they haven't scored in, I would guess that's pretty rare for title winners. They probably won't want to go 5 or 6.
Quite an interesting personality trait, isn't it, compared to the other two, that they have been more likely to score 5, 6, but also more likely to draw a blank.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
When it comes to City, well, they played last night and they played a team that had beaten them as comfortably as almost any team has ever beaten Pep Guardiola's Man City in the reverse fixture. That was Aston Villa. But a 4-1 win for City, Michael. Impressive result for sure. Added context. Well, last time we spoke about them, you mentioned that for you, they were the favourites. And one of the reasons was, in your eyes, they had the best defensive holding midfield player in Rodri, the best creator in De Bruyne, and the best goalscorer in Haaland. But last night, only Rodri played, with the other two left out.
Yeah, I mean, Haaland hasn't been in great form. I don't think De Bruyne's completely looked himself since he came back from injury. It was funny last night. I actually didn't think they were that convincing in the first half, but I thought the second half they were excellent. They were constantly able to go through the centre of Villa, which I think is quite rare because Villa's so well organised, so compact. But I really just thought it was about two players. I think Rodri and Foden, both of them, two of the best individual performances I've seen all season. Mm. Foden was absolutely fantastic, obviously, in terms of the goals that he scored. But Rodri, I mean, I think he's the best holding midfielder in the league, but he's also so good in the box. You know, the run he made, the Villa players saw his run. They just couldn't work out who was supposed to be tracking him. And he so often comes up with really good contributions in the box, of course, including the Champions League final last year. So, yeah, it's a funny team at the moment, City, because I'm not sure their star players are really on top of their game. And as well as those two, I'd say Bernardo Silva, who I think first half of the season was pretty much as good as any player in the league, maybe hasn't quite been at his best recently, but they've got players who are stepping up.
There's a couple of things that stood out last night rewatching the game back, City still having an issue defending fast breaks. They've conceded 7 goals now, including one last night from fast breaks, a proxy of counter-attacking from sort of deep in the opposition's own half. It's been a problem they've kind of had all season and not just in the Premier League, but it's something that if you compare them to Arsenal, Arsenal have only conceded twice from fast breaks all season and not since September, so very early on. They've conceded the second fewest shots from fast breaks, and City are joint top for fast break goals conceded with Crystal Palace, which isn't an area you want to be sort of as a possession team. Arsenal really just sort of munching teams whenever they try and go the other way. City's wasn't quite the same. Like, part of me felt it was possibly due to the personnel that Rodri at times looked a little bit isolated as a real physical presence to make fouls or sort of to step in. I really liked, actually, I know Mark was the same, of seeing Doku off the right playing sort of with Grealish on the left as sort of two different sides. The left side felt a lot more about combinations with Bernardo Silva making runs into the channel and trying to sort of find 1-2s and solutions that way. Whereas the right side felt a little bit more just sort of space for Doku to go 1v1 because Rico Lewis would move into midfield. So it was sort of more, a little bit more freestyle, I guess, than sort of the left side, which felt a little bit more sort of pass heavy. But then the
also
downside...
Also makes sense to me anyway for Doku to be beating his man, which he does very well, onto his right foot to set up a cross or a cutback rather than to set up a shot. Because if there's one thing that to me has been a pretty obvious weakness in his game compared to all the elite level players that surround him has been his shooting, his technique and his finishing has been pretty poor. He hasn't offered goal threat at all. So that goal, that was what sprung to mind last night, popping up on the right, getting that space because he will more times than not, and cutting it back for a teammate to have that final moment is... Yeah, to my eyes, that seems intuitive.
I mean, he has been really poor in terms of his end product for a long time now. Until last night, he didn't have any goals or assists in the Premier League. Going back to the 4th of November, when City beat Bournemouth 6-1, and he was absolutely sensational. He got 4 assists that day. But, I mean, it's almost like fullbacks have really watched the videos on him and worked out, you know, there's ways you can stop him.
Or maybe that could be a defining aspect of the next 6 weeks for City. Doku off the right.
I think so. And the reason why, and Liam and I were speaking about it this morning, is that you can have, to your point, Ali, you can go round the side, especially because City don't have the fullbacks to be able to sort of overlap. But if the opposition is going to be really congested and stay really tight, then you can go round the block and maybe get a cutback. But again, to Michael's point, what City were doing fantastically with their little neat, intricate play with Rico Lewis as well, who I thought was fantastic against Villa, was... Just trying to go through the middle, Rodri making runs as well, and have those sort of neat passes. And if they are going to be really congested and they get a foul, then Manchester City get a free kick and Foden scores from the free kick as well. So there's kind of solutions everywhere, which is quite daunting for Arsenal Liverpool.
And his tendency, Doku, to hold the width really well was causing Villa real problems down the left side, sort of not knowing when the fullback should go, but then when the fullback steps out to go to him, it opens up the space in the middle. So I think he was really useful, and sure, this is just sort of a positioning thing, but in actually creating the space for Foden, for Rodri to be really disruptive. And then without the ball in the press, he was really, really excellent, making these great curved runs that we've seen from City a lot in their press, and going really aggressively, which was something that actually Villa sort of picked them apart in the reverse fixture when they could get those number 10s sort of on the ball and turning. And sure, there was no Ollie Watkins this time, but you can only play what you're up against. And yeah, it was great from Doku making those curve runs onto, I think it's Clement Longley, the left centre back. And there's a real period in the first half where they pinned Villa back a lot. As I said, their defending of transitions was quite poor a lot of the time. There were a couple of chances. I think Douglas Luiz has one, and Zaniolo in the second half at 2-1, where, you know, on another day that becomes 2-2. In open play, they were great at really pinning Villa in, didn't let them get out through the patterns they want, a rotated Villa side or not, and that back line were just eating up anything that was coming sort of long from the goalkeeper.
Well, let's talk about Villa more specifically, and outside of the context of that specific match on Wednesday night. They are within a group of teams that have been dubbed the Kingmakers by Tim Spears, your Athletic colleague, wrote a brilliant piece on site this week. These three teams, Aston Villa, Tottenham Hotspur and Wolverhampton Wanderers, are crucial in the title conversation because the title contenders have all played each other twice now this season. And these three teams, Villa, Spurs and Wolves, if you include last night's game between Villa and City, have to play all three of the sides that we're focusing on. So all three of these teams are interesting to discuss. Villa in particular, because they made it so difficult for Arsenal and City at home, not just beating them in those games at Villa Park, but the manner in which they did so. They host Liverpool on the penultimate weekend of the season on the 11th of May. They travel to Arsenal next Sunday. But there's also a sense that, partly due to the fact they are missing 11 first-team players, as we saw last night, and played well against City in parts but weren't able to replicate that performance over a full 90. Is there a sense that they've dropped off a little bit in terms of the performance levels that they're able to put together?
Probably a bit. I think they're another example of a team having a phenomenal starting 11 and really good plan A tactically. And then if they got, you know, they're a really specifically excellent team when they score first and go ahead. They're one of the most horrible teams. I think if you go one or down against them, you go, we're in for a real sort of long day here. And obviously then they've then got that balance up top. I think it was on this podcast, I said in the summer, I was a bit sceptical about Moussa Diaby and Ollie Watkins in the same team as I felt two similar profiles. Funnily enough, I've been completely proved wrong. Who'd have thought that? Diaby's looked absolutely excellent. His strength in sort of carrying, his ability or his technique sort of in tight areas when he gets pressed. He's ended up being a really good partner for Watkins, who, as we've seen, has become really creative this season. And Villa really missed him at City, especially you miss the outlook, really being able to run the channels, because as soon as you're trying to go, I think, 1v1 or battle aerially up against some of those big defenders, which is the case for Arsenal, City and Liverpool, that all have just got big lads at the back who are really good in the air. So I think they're very much a different animal at home, as we saw in the, you know, it was the two games in a week, I think, wasn't it, when they won 1-0. So I think that's probably the, and when it comes in the season as well, obviously, I think everyone kind of hopes it goes to the final day because that will be more exciting. But I think that's probably the biggest game that Liverpool have got to go there on. You know, if Villa are, however they're doing in the Conference League, is obviously going to impact that as well in terms of injuries and rotation and minutes. But you think theoretically, if they're sort of cut adrift in their league position and their season's wrapped up, you've just got a chance to spoil the party. I'm sure they'd be right up for that.
Yeah, I think that Liverpool one will be interesting. I mean, you said about it, Liam, in terms of their counter-attacking threat against Man City. That was the case. And if they did have all of their players or their better players on the pitch, then that threat would have been more potent. And probably between Arsenal, City and Liverpool, I think Liverpool would be the ones to struggle the most with that counter-attack. Despite what I was saying about Endo being stronger, I still think that would be the case. But I think with Liverpool, if you go back to their game against Villa at Anfield, that Villa's high line, I know we speak about it a lot, but it was really exposed by Liverpool, specifically Trent Alexander-Arnold coming between the centre-backs and Mohamed Salah making those runs from out to in. And if they do that again, you know, even at Villa Park, then Liverpool have got the personnel and profile of player to be able to expose that with kind of longer balls. So I think Villa's counter-attacking threat is still there and will be the most threatening to Liverpool. But Liverpool do have the antidote to that with their own sort of long balls to get behind Villa's high line.
Their game against Arsenal, Michael, what's interesting tactically there? There's obviously Unai Emery narratives. There's also a memorable game from last season, which Arsenal won 4-2, and Emery was critical of Emi Martinez in that game, partly for kicking long too often, and then for going up to try and score from a corner at 3-2 and conceding the fourth.
That doesn't include an own goal he scored, which was unlucky, but shocking day.
Can't blame him, a keeper, for unlucky own goals. But, I mean, the way in which Emery responded to specifically the long kicking from the goalkeeper makes it seem clear that they will try and approach the game in a different way at Arsenal. Do you have any sense that they could hurt them?
Well, I think that's interesting in relation to how Arsenal played last night against Luton, because I don't think I've seen for a long time a side struggle to play out as much as Luton did. I mean, they constantly conceded possession on the edge of their own box. And I think if you're another manager watching that, you'd be quite tempted to just get past that Arsenal press, because it was probably as ferocious as I've seen it. Certainly in the first half last night, they seemed to dip off a little bit in the second half. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how he squares that. But I think Arsenal are really good without the ball at the moment. They're really, really good. And
have they basically completed defending as an elite team? I know that Chelsea's goals conceded record is unlikely to ever be beaten, and I can't conjure exactly how that looked defensively and Mourinho's shape and the reasons they were that good. But in the modern era, I mean, it's remarkable what Arsenal are doing right now.
And in the context of a season that's one of the highest scoring Premier League seasons in recent history, like, I think relatively speaking, I don't necessarily mean it's like a proportion of goals that they've conceded in the league, but teams are scoring a lot more now, right the way down through the leagues. It's not just a few top teams that are sort of smashing loads of goals. Yeah, I think you've got to factor in the context there, and they are ridiculously good.
I think the only thing you'd say as well, though, is that Liam spoke about it recently when Porto split their centre-backs really wide to get around Arsenal's initial press to try and go around them a little bit more. Man City at the weekend brought Mateo Kovacic into basically left centre-back to try and entice Odegaard and Saka towards them. But in the same breath, they didn't concede on either of those games either. So yes, it was a sort of a tactic to try and go around it, but you know, they were still super strong.
Right, and there'll be an extent to which Arsenal will back themselves, even if teams are splitting their wide centre-backs, and will be, if anything, more excited because of the opportunities that may come their way if those centre-backs lose the ball and suddenly have huge spaces between them.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code The Athletic. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF-IN-IOWA. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When it comes to Tottenham, I mean, these games between Spurs and Arsenal on Sunday, April the 25th, Liverpool, Spurs on the 4th of May, and then Manchester City travelling to Spurs, date TBC. These are going to be very, very entertaining, would be a not particularly hot take or strong prediction or impressive prediction, because Ange Postecoglou has made it pretty clear the way that he wants his team to approach these games, and there is a, shall we say, high risk, high reward aspect to it. A quote from Tim's piece when Postecoglou was asked about this just said, "You look at the top teams and there's one common trademark amongst them. They've all got a plan. They invest in that plan and they stick to it. They don't shy away from that at the first difficulty, whether it is City or Arsenal or Liverpool. They've got a plan and they stick to it. You have to, mate." So, Liam, what does that mean in the context of these games, which are going to be massive in the context of the title race?
Well, I think if you look specifically at the Arsenal and City games, they're both at home. Spurs in the league this season haven't drawn a game at home, so it's been all or nothing, 11 wins, 4 losses. Both teams have scored in 11 of those, which just makes it very entertaining a lot of the time. It can be Spurs going ahead or going sort of 1-0 down. They've used their bench quite well, I think, in recent games. They're weirdly sort of strong starters in both halves. They scored early at West Ham in the week, and again off a really nice sort of flowing cutback move. Ahmed Waleed, big friend of the pod, did a great piece on that, on sort of how it's often actually early in the season it was sort of Son as the number nine sort of crashing between the posts for one touch finishes. Also Richarlison for a period scoring like all of his shots within about a 10-yard distance from goal. Whereas now it tends to be Son dropping out a lot of the time, and actually it might be Brennan Johnson or the left winger who's sort of crashing in the in between the posts. And that will definitely be a big test, I think. Obviously, it's typically the goal we sort of associate with City and Liverpool to a degree, but I think it'll be a big test for Arsenal out of possession, because they are so rotation heavy that they can be quite hard to sort of press man for man against, which a lot of these teams like to do, or go from that 4-4-2 mid block to the high press. There was an example earlier this season when Brighton tried to do it and go man for man and ended up with a centre back basically on James Maddison in Spurs' like defensive third when Spurs are building up. And their solution for that was, well, we're just going to get a midfielder crashing through the middle now because you've vacated space closer to your own goal, and ended up being sort of the route to the equaliser. So it'll be a case of either someone's going to have to tweak something, or it's going to be really good because it's going to be, you know, a really, really strong aggressive press and rotational build-up up against a really, really strong press and probably a rotational build-up. If that goes wrong on either end, it's going to be teams getting carved apart.
I think as well it's interesting that knowing how dogmatic Ange Postecoglou is in terms of Spurs' build-up, looking at the numbers, Spurs are the team who cede possession the most in their own defensive third per 90, more than any other side. So 6.9 times per 90. And then you think about Manchester City, Arsenal, Liverpool. They are three of the top four, the other being Spurs, who have won the ball back most often in the attacking third. So you're sort of playing against teams who are extremely strong at high pressing, suffocating the opposition, winning the ball high up. And you yourself are a side who likes to build up in a really considered manner. And we've seen it across multiple games this season where even when it maybe goes wrong a little bit with Spurs, they still carry on, they still play their game. They're not willing to change for anyone, as you said with that quote, Ali. So that will be interesting to see, especially when so much is on the line, especially when tensions are high. I think that could be kind of key to each of the games.
Do you think, Michael, because we're talking about three teams who they're done with process, they are now winning football teams, elite winning football teams, is there a sense that actually they might enjoy games against a team who are openly going through the process, working it out as they go? They must be licking their lips to an extent.
I did think that, although Tottenham's results against the big three have been pretty good so far, and the performances as well. One thing I do think could be crucial is set pieces. I mean, Spurs are not good in that respect. Defensively, they conceded another one to Kurt Zouma's head in midweek. And if you look at the set-piece goal difference, if I can use that expression, Arsenal on 13, City 12, Liverpool quite a way back on 4, and Spurs on 0. So, you know, for a side who dominates so much in terms of territory, possession, to be conceding as many set-pieces as they're scoring, I think really does point to a bit of a weakness.
Not to go Adam Hurry, but set-piece goal difference, my personal adjudication, approved. And Wolves also play all three. They're in 10th at the moment, Wolves. It's been a really impressive campaign. Gary O'Neill, the manager, has actually live on TV to the nation explained a specific game plan which won them a match against Manchester City. They play Arsenal first at home on the 20th of April. Then they travel to City on the 4th of May and Liverpool on final day. And they have a track record, Michael, of making problems for these teams this season.
I actually haven't watched that, Gary. Was that the Monday Night Football thing? Was that the City game? Mm. Right, I actually haven't seen that, but I did watch that game back
in
full.
Didn't need him to explain it because you'd already seen it.
Well, I mean, it was one of the most impressive performances I've seen this season. They caused City so many problems in terms of the pressing, particularly Nunes against his former side had a really disappointing game. Kovacic struggled as well. I think that'll be a tough one. I think the Arsenal trip there is going to be really tough because they've got Bayern away on the Wednesday and then they've got Wolves away the Saturday evening. And I have no data to back this up, but I feel like evening games are tougher away from home. The atmosphere's better. You know, I think that'll be a really difficult one for them. And Wolves, they're not a great side, but they're a very frustrating side to play against. So I think that could be the one where Arsenal have a bit of trouble. You'd still back him to win, but I think that won't be easy at all.
I've always had a theory that playing Palace away on a Monday night is about as hard as it gets. But Palace away on any other day of the week.
Saturday 3 p.m. fine, isn't it?
For exactly that reason. Liam, what are the specifics of why Wolves make it so difficult for these types of teams? What is it tactically?
Well, if you use the City game as a specific example, they're nice and adapted to the specific strengths of the profiles of the opposition. So he makes a big point about Haaland liking to make these sort of channel runs in the left half space. So they went, I think it was man for man from a back five, the left centre back went, I think it was Totti, went tight to Phil Foden, whereas on the right hand side, Mats Kilman and I think it was Craig Dawson would be a little bit more loose so that they could cover sort of 2v1 against Haaland. And they'd sort of tuck in their right central midfielder of the midfield three, again, to sort of condense that space. And he made a big point as well about having sort of, you know, forward to just, we spoke about how good Rodri is and how good City are in central midfield, basically just being really disruptive and making loads of tackles, just getting in the way, stopping their build-up. There was a really funny sort of quote from Gary Neal after the Villa game as well, where he's speaking about XG and how, like, the with the conversion of chances being higher when you've got your better players in the team. And it was just quite silly the way that you said it, about like, oh, we had this amount of XG, but if we'd have had our better players, that XG is almost higher because you'd score more. Kind of got his point. It just sounded quite nerdy and quite silly from him, but it speaks to the point as well about
there's a way of making that point without bringing up XG.
Yeah,
that would probably land
attack better with our better attackers, which is just very true that if they've not got, I think Pedro Neto and Matheus Cunha in particular, I think Pedro Neto is phenomenal to watch. And yeah, I think for Wolves, it's going to massively hinge on the availability of Matheus Cunha and Pedro Neto. I doubt Pedro Neto will be at the club much, you know, beyond this season. Just he's so good. But they're the threats, really, especially when you've got City moving a fullback inside, like we've said, or if Arsenal play that way, when you are expansive and you commit bodies forward, that's the output, is that one big sort of diagonal or chip in behind to wing them and let them go. That was the way against City, where they didn't actually have that many shots, but there were quite a few chances where they did get in behind and the cutback didn't quite come off. And you won't have as many chances, but they will end up creating really high value chances because they're going to get so close to goal without many defenders in the way.
I think that City-Wolves game, I think they only actually had one shot, but they scored two goals because Nathan Ake, it was an own goal, even though Pedro Neto just basically ran Hathaway at the length of the field. But I think, yeah, to agree with the guys, I think it all hinges upon the players that they have to implement the counter-attacking style that Wolves are so strong at. And looking at the numbers, they have the second most shots from fast breaks this season. So it's a real strength of theirs. They implement it really well when they got the players to do so. So I think, yeah, Arsenal probably will be sort of the most under threat there. I think the Liverpool game, because it's on the last game of the season, as it has been a couple of times in recent years, it was in the 2018-19 season and the 21-22 season, both of which were games where Liverpool needed to win and the title was still on the line on that last day. This could be the third time in a few years that is the case. I think because of that potential emotion and narrative, etc., I think kind of maybe tactics will go out the window a little bit there because it'll be potentially something of a cup final, so to speak. But I think the Arsenal game, if they can get their sort of counter-attacking style right on the night, that could be the biggest threat.
Wolverhampton Wanderers, kingmakers. And then just quickly, Chelsea travelled to Arsenal on the 23rd of April. Could that be a potential king-killing fixture if Arsenal were to drop points? I don't really understand my own thoughts on Chelsea at the moment. They have played quite well in some of the games against the top three, drawing against City twice, 4-4 and 1-1. A 2-2 draw with Arsenal at Stamford Bridge. They drew with Liverpool as well in that crazy opening day fixture and lost 4-1. At Anfield. So they haven't won any of these fixtures so far, but have caused some problems at times. But then again, Michael, maybe there's something about what we mentioned with Tottenham. They are still going through a process. They are still working things out. And very visibly, I think, within games, they are capable of periods of looking very dangerous with talented players performing well. But there is that flimsiness as well within them.
Yeah, very confusingly, in terms of expected goal difference, they've got the fourth best figures in the league. And actually, in terms of their own expected goals, they're only three behind City and Arsenal.
Wow.
Which is quite extraordinary, really, because they are 12th in the league as we're recording.
And remember, if you don't believe that, stats are just counting things that have happened.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're quite poor defensively. I don't think they've got any real relationships at the back. You know, chopping and changing, partly because of injuries in the fullback positions. I don't think they have much of a solid defensive base, but they can cause problems going forward. So yeah, I think those games will be quite interesting. There is a bit of a fearlessness about Chelsea, the way that they're playing with so many young players, and the fact they're not really fighting for anything, I think maybe in terms of long-term development might actually be fairly useful. So yeah, I think those games could be interesting.
Well, no one talked to me or contact me between the 20th and the 28th of April because I'm off comms and I'm focusing on football and specifically the Premier League's three-horse title race. Why those dates? Because in that period, both City and Liverpool have three away games in a row. That's going to be huge. And in the same period, Arsenal, they host Chelsea, but they also travel to Spurs and Wolves, two of our kingmakers from the episode. I hope that that wets the whistle for the next 6 weeks of the Premier League season. Checking back in after we analysed the title race 5 weeks or so ago, and I'm sure we've got one more in us if things stay as tight as they are. Thank you to Michael, to Mark, and to Liam as well, and Tim Spears for that lovely piece on site. Sign up to The Athletic today at theathletic.com/tactics, where you'll find a discount on an annual subscription, and subscribe to this podcast feed so that you get next week's episode as soon as it drops. Thank you for listening. Join us again next week on The Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.